Oh, hi, I didn't see you there. My name's Steve Marks, and I'd like to welcome you to a very special episode of Cloud Cover.
Steve, what are you doing?
I gotta be honest with you, Wade, I have no idea what I'm doing.
All right, let's get this thing rolling. Welcome to Cloud Cover!
Hi, welcome to Cloud Cover. I'm Steve Marks.
And I'm Wade Wegner.
And we've got a great show this week. We're actually, this is kind of a revisiting of Startup Task because Ryan and I last year covered Startup Task in just sort of the basics right after PDC and after they were announced. Now, Wade and I have some experience under our belts, and I think it's time to come back to this, talk about some of the pro tips for how to actually do this stuff.
We alluded to it in the Hard Hat Edition.
Hard Hat Edition.
Our incremental
best
show.
Best show ever.
And so we're gonna go through that stuff.
Yeah, but before that, we'll cover some of the news that's come up, and of course, we'll wrap up with a tip of the week that's actually going to be about remote desktop.
Yep.
So let's see what's in the news.
All right. So the first thing is, recently on the IIS blog, WebPI command line was announced. So we're going to get into this and kind of demonstrate what it is and how to use it. But any of you that have used the WebPI web platform installer are probably familiar with the concept, but it's essentially a way to install your applications and some programs through the WebPI tool. And this is actually a command line tool, so it makes scripting and automating the installation of these things a lot easier.
Yeah, and the thing I love about web platform installer is that it understands all the dependencies,
yes.
Which means if you try to install something, it'll make sure you've got the right bits in place for it.
Yeah.
Which makes it very handy for some of the stuff we're going to talk about later, which is getting into a known good state, and this is how you can do it from the command line. So.
Yeah, and actually, there's actually two versions in the release. There's a 32-bit and a 64-bit. Right.
And
so
then any CPU.
The any CPU.
It's actually, right,
yep,
the other one's
right.
Any CPU, which is the one you should use in Windows Azure.
Correct. So the x86 one is great for development locally, but the any CPU is what we'll end up showing you later on.
Yep.
It's great.
Cool. What do we have next?
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Christian
this
Wire.
Is a blog post from one of our MVPs, Christian Wire, who has been working with, there's this known issue, actually, with SDK 1.3 around permissions and diagnostics, and the directories where log files get stored have permissions that work okay depending on what you're doing, but can be a problem when IIS has to write logs there, and then diagnostics has to pull them out. And so it's a little bit tricky, and Christian built a startup task that resets the permissions on a directory. And he's actually doing it for his own local resource trace files where he's writing out WCF traces. But the same thing applies if you just want to apply it to all of your diagnostic settings and whatever. Now, I should point out the caveat that he points out, which is that this just sets everything to everyone full access, which is probably not the recommended secure way to do
it. Execution policy unrestricted, right?
So he's running this PowerShell. We'll talk about this tip later. Yep. The execution policy thing. He's running this PowerShell script. If you scroll down, there's a little. This is my favorite line of code ever. Do you see the while loop? Can you highlight for everybody the condition of the while loop? Just looks like somebody's swearing.
It does. It's what?
that means while the previous command didn't succeed. That's
nice.
What that line
nice.
Is.
That's good.
So
I was not familiar with that.
No, I helped Christian with this, and that I was really happy about that line. so anyway, but then this sets the permissions on everything to this full control and whatever, which means all your diagnostic stuff will work. But you should think about what the right ACLs are. It sounds like I think Christian might do a follow up, or he tries to narrow down exactly what permissions you need to make IIS able to write to the directory and do that. But anyway. Cool thing that makes use of startup tasks, which is, of course, our theme.
Theme to the show.
See, it's like we planned this and thought this through.
It's kind of scary.
Yeah.
All right. Next one.
Who's this guy?
Wade Wegner. So
never heard of him.
Programmatically changing the app pool identity. So we've been playing around a lot with the startup tasks, and one of the things that we have are some challenging corporate proxies.
Uh-huh.
And so we've learned a little bit from it, and so this is a general purpose tip. So in the onstart of your web role, to be able to actually go in and programmatically make changes to settings metadata within IIS. Now, in this particular case, what I'm doing is actually changing the app pool identity.
Yeah.
So when you deploy, especially locally when you deploy, it creates a new app pool, deploys your application, the app pool by default is network service. So we needed to make some changes here so that it wasn't running as network service. So this is a way to change that so now it's running as a domain account. Now what's interesting about this is you could do other things. So not only change the identity of the app pool, but there's a recycle period on the app pool. What is it, like 36 hours or there's an arbitrary number?
Yeah.
But if you wanted to have a little bit more control over, you know, the periods in which your app pools recycle, you could programmatically change it here. You can actually make some other changes that we'll allude to, like enabling 32-bit processes to run in a 64-bit IIS host, things like that. So you can control a lot of those things.
And you might think that you should do this sort of thing in a startup task, which is a good impulse that you had. Congratulations to you for thinking that. But the timing of when the app pool gets set up and the sites get created in IIS and whatever is such that in a startup task, you won't actually see them yet. So you'll have code that you think is perfectly reasonable in a startup task, but you won't actually be able to modify the actual app pool that you need. And that's why Wade ended up putting this in OnStart, which means you need to set your role to execute as administrator, as well, elevated privileges. And it doesn't impact IIS stuff. Still runs as well. I mean, the whole point of this is that IIS is
running a different identity,
network service, and whatever. But this way, your startup code in your role can actually do this stuff.
Yep.
So you can do a lot with. I've been doing some weird stuff with this, like setting up application request routing and things like that.
Nice.
There's a lot that you can do. So very cool technique on Wade's blog. This is sharing files in Windows Azure Connect. This is from the Connect team. They basically. Windows Azure Connect means that you get everything to be on like the same network overlay, and so you can have your desktop and your machines in the cloud all able to talk to each other at the IP level.
Cool. Yep.
It's very neat technology. And it means that people are starting to do all sorts of stuff that they would normally do with servers and whatever, like setting up a network share.
Yep.
So that's what this post is about, is what do you have to do to get file sharing to work? And the only reason this is interesting, I think, is that their firewall settings that are typically set up in a Windows Azure VM won't let just NetShare work. So you actually need to go through and modify firewall settings.
So it walks through that.
This shows you how to do it manually. If you were going to actually, if this is part of your app that you need to do network sharing and whatever, then you would need to automate this stuff. And I actually, I haven't seen it done yet. I don't know how you automate the firewall setup. I'm sure
there's a way.
I'm sure it's not that hard. You just have to find it.
Yeah.
So anyway, so kind of cool, and it's actually kind of amazing that you can do that. I think
it is,
the idea
it is
that you're
going
to be on a VM in our data center and just type NetShare, and then from your machine, copy files back and forth.
That is pretty awesome.
It shows you how cool Windows Azure Connect is. So,
that's a good news item.
Cool.
All right, so next, we've got this
another unknown
blog.smarks.com.
Who knows who this guy is? But this is actually a good transition into what we're going to talk about, because I, in preparation for this show, put up a couple blog posts about startup tasks, and this one is just sort of an introduction that really just shows you how to do it, just the basics. And then the next post that I have up is about some tips, tricks, and gotchas, and that's really what I think we're going to focus on for the rest of... We're actually going to use an example that Wade has, but we're going to talk through a bunch of the stuff that I've put in this blog post about...
Yeah, it's kind of a distillation of all the tips and tricks, so... Anything else you want to highlight here?
I think this is really...
Just something you should
take a
look at.
Cloud Cover episode 31, but in text form, because there's where Ryan and I did classic ASP in the cloud.
All right, so let's go to the tips, tricks, and gotchas.
I should point out, actually, one thing, you asked me, you gave me the opportunity.
Gotcha. And you came up.
I failed.
No.
But
you can go back.
The nice thing about those tabs is you just click them. at the very bottom of this post, almost at the bottom of the post, there's a link there for downloading the code, which is actually, this might be a nice jumping off point for if you're building your own startup task and something's not showing up in the right directory, or your code doesn't seem to run, and you just want a sample that works.
Take a look at the way this is.
This one actually works, and it's got almost nothing in it because it has a default.asp because it's showing classic ASP.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's like an empty project except a startup task and a batch file. It's like a one-line batch file. So it's actually a very good jumping-off point. I've used this before to sort of jumpstart a startup thing. So
good.
That's the only other thing that we should point out there, even if you know everything else. The source code is useful there.
Great.
And now, we should transition into the feature that we're going to talk about, which is startup tasks and really how to debug them, how to get all the little things right that you might get wrong if you didn't watch the show first. And I don't know. Let's skim through a few of them and talk about them, and then I definitely want to get to your sample. Do you think we should show that first? Can we just show it working?
Should we start at the end real quick?
Let's start at the end. Let's show sure. your, because Wade has a very cool app that I think people will be excited about by itself, and it's enabled by Startup Test. So this will be your motivation for why.
I'm assuming you're talking about Windows Azure Encoder.
I am talking about that. I mean, you have other lame examples also, but I'm talking about the super cool encoding in the cloud.
So it's already published. So you can go to encoder.cloudapp.net, and I've got some authentication because I want to keep track of users. But essentially what this allows you to do is go through and encode video. So it actually uses Expression Encoder for running up in a worker role. And then here we've got a web role that's actually just handling the website for us to allow us to process some things. So you can come here.
Looks familiar. The theme looks a little familiar.
Yeah, I'm not very creative in terms of which theme to choose.
And there's no dancing MC Hammer, so clearly I had no part in this.
That's not Hammer time. So what I've done is I've actually included three videos right now that you can use to just to get started rather than forcing everyone to upload it. And
rather than allowing everyone to upload whatever videos they wanted.
That is a good point. but I also wanted to have something to demonstrate that we're actually doing some encoding behind the scenes, right? Rather than say, you know, someone might say, are you sure you're not just copying something over?
Yeah. I built a similar app and it was just static HTML that pointed to encode this. Okay, here it's done.
So you can end up saying, you know, cloud cover, I'm going to say text overlay, say, hey, Wade and Steve. And so what this is going to do is actually take the overlay text, turn it into a bitmap, and then actually overlay it through the entire video. So we get a demonstration that actually that something's happening here.
Right.
And then we'll choose a video to encode. So we'll choose the Cloud Cover Hardhead Edition. Now, I'm not the Ajax wizard you are, so there's not a lot of funky Ajax stuff going on. Basically, I need to do some refreshes. But if we come here and take a look at results, now it takes a few seconds here to actually encode, right?
It's actually re-encoding the video, right? Yep. I mean, the overlay is actually getting encoded in.
Absolutely.
Right?
So, now, if we didn't add the overlay, this actually gets done pretty quickly, 5-10 seconds. But the overlay, it runs through the entire video.
Right.
And so if you want to give this a try, you know, refresh, be a little bit patient. It probably takes 20, 30 seconds. Hopefully, we don't wait too long here.
And this is actually how we're going to encode all future episodes of Cloud Cover, right?
Right.
We're going to take our, 30-minute high-resolution thing.
And we're just going to overlay a bunch of random text on
and
top
then,
of it.
Oh, yeah. That would be cool, actually. Except it has to be the same text through the whole...
Yeah,
that's
so
too bad.
So while this is going, let me come back here real quick, and I'll show you the pieces here. And there'll be a blog post breaking this down. I'll include the sample. Everyone can get access to it. But right here, this encoder workers is the actual worker role.
Yep.
And one thing to note, and this show is not about this, but the expression encoder for assembly is 32-bit, so there's some issues in terms of how you use that within 64-bit hosts within Windows Azure.
Right.
So what the application actually does is it actually will create a new process and start that new process, and that allows it to run as a 32-bit process. I'll walk through that stuff in the blog post. What that means is the worker role actually spawns a bunch of additional processes that run and do the encoding for us within the cloud. Now we'll walk through the startup tasks, but we actually have to install Expression Encoder in the worker role in order to do the encoding.
And this is the place where people probably think, oh, I should probably just use a VM role,
yes,
and I should install this and whatever. And you can do that.
Yeah.
I mean, and in fact,
you can
people have done that.
Yep.
And,
yes.
And you can do that. But that means you have to create a whole VM.
You got to upload
the whole thing, which
you got to maintain it.
Right. And then every time there's a patch, you're going to have to. I mean, you take all this responsibility.
So this is where the startup tasks end up shining.
Startup tasks come in handy for this. It turns out it's not that hard. I mean, we've both had a lot of trouble learning to use startup tasks well, and they're. I'm not going to say it was easy to get there, but as we show people this code, I think they'll be impressed with how little there is.
Well, what's interesting is once you're done and you get that end state, it looks pretty simple.
We're
going to go through it, and we've built this up to be something, and it's going to be, oh, it's
we had this moment before the show where it was like, well, there's almost nothing
here to show.
Do we not have enough
should we
to
just,
show?
Should we just show?
Yeah, sure.
Let's just show.
Hey, well, did we finish our encoding? Let's not leave people hanging. They're
going to
think there's some trickery happening here.
Well, let's do that refresh. There it is.
There it is.
All right, so you see Cloud Cover, that was the job name.
Yep.
And when we run it,
we're going to see what. Hi, there you go.
There we go.
Hey, Wade and Steve.
So thank you for encoding this video, Wade Wegner, which, by the way, the name is coming through a claim provided by Access Control Service. And then we overlay via message, hey, Wade and Steve.
This is why I can't use it, because I don't have a Facebook account or a Yahoo
or
account.
Or Yahoo, yeah. So.
And so I couldn't do it.
Yep. I'll add Live ID in there.
This is very meta. We're going to like watch a video of Cloud
Cover during
Cloud
ourselves while we're doing it.
Okay, so let's now that people know how awesome it is, because you can do very cool stuff.
Yep. Let's take a look at it.
How did you do this? It's sort of underwhelming.
Let's come here over to the service definition and take a look at that.
Okay.
Right. So.
Right, because this has the, this is sort of the starting point. You might want to bump up. Can you do? Oh wow, you knew all the shortcuts and stuff. This is kind of where it starts, I guess, in a sense, because this is. I mean, there are two pieces really, which is one, you have to tell Windows Azure that you have a startup task and what it should run.
And we define it here within the service.
And then
model.
The other piece is that you have to actually
have
author
the
thing, right?
Yep.
And here, as is common, I think, you're using a batch file, .cmd as the task. You're saying to run an elevated, which you're going to need to do for a lot of your startup tasks, because a lot of the reason you have a startup task is probably because you need to do
something that a normal user can't do.
Right, and because otherwise you might just do it in onstart or in whatever. So execution context elevated, and then task type. We should let's hold off on really talking about what the task type does for now, but
defines how
mental bookmark, right? Yes. It's there, and it defines kind of how it runs.
All right. So this is what it's going to call when it's actually setting up.
And that's
up.
It, right? I mean, the rest of this stuff is boilerplate, you know, Windows Azure stuff for your web and worker role, whatever.
And so now let's actually take a look at the script itself. So. Here's what it is. So the very first thing we need to do, now this one is, so these are going to be different based on what it is you're trying to,
you're installing,
trying to do, right? In the case of Expression Encoder 4, you need to have the desktop experience installed in Windows Server 2008.
Which is the name of, my band.
Desktop experience?
Steve Marks and the Desktop Experience,
nice.
Yes.
Nice. So the very first thing it does is runs Server Manager command. There's a couple of different ways to do this. I chose this where we say install desktop experience.
Yep.
Now, one thing to highlight here is this restart. What it's doing is to get the desktop experience to actually install, you need to restart the machine.
Right.
So after it executes this command, the machine restarts right in the middle of running the startup task.
Right.
So what's interesting is the fact that this is it needs to be idempotent, the fact that it's going to run through everything again. After the machine restarts, the startup task is going to run again. It's going to try to install the desktop experience. Fortunately, this tool is smart enough that if it's been installed, doesn't have any problems. It just skips it and moves on to the next step. Now, this next part looks a little bit funky. So
yeah,
let's talk a little bit about
skip the registry things, because we can actually go back to my blog post.
Okay, we'll do that.
And there it's a little clearer. But I think the line for people to look at is this one sandwiched in there, which is just calling to the web platform installer command line tool,
which is what we mentioned earlier on in the news.
Look how simple it is.
So let's break down. So we call web PI command line.
Yep.
We accept the EULA. So
don't forget to do this, because
otherwise it pops up a window and
it will sit there waiting forever for you to say yes.
Yes.
I think actually in the new, I think the release web PI command line, it's not actually window. I think it'll be in the console.
In the console.
If you try this yourself, it'll just go and it'll say press Y or N.
And this is different from when. So Ryan and I had posted on web deploy a while back. We did not include this flag, because in that version of web PI command line, it wasn't needed.
It didn't have it, right.
And so you do need it now, so don't forget that. And then you can choose the product. And there's a number of different products. One of the easiest ways actually to figure out which product and what to name it is, I always go, I don't know how you do this, but I actually go to the feed and take a look at the feed and open the XML.
There's some other, can't you do web PI command line slash
list
or something,
and
it'll give you
the
list? But I do the same thing. I go to
because then I can just do control F, do a find. Find what I'm looking for.
So right, do you need to know the ID of the product, which in this case is just
Expression Encoder 4. And then you can log. And this is actually really handy when you're getting things set up for the first time and debugging, logging everything out. In fact, I did that when I installed the desktop experience as well.
Right, that had an XML file with some
because because, and we'll get to how we can go about doing this shortly, but there are times when something just doesn't work the way you expect it in the startup task, and being able to take a look at that process to see where it failed.
Absolutely.
That's important.
Okay,
so,
and skipping the registry stuff around there is one other line in this that I think is
worth
important,
more.
Is this last line, which just says return a success code, right? Error level 0, which means success, from this batch file. It's important to do this because you you need to return success. We'll think the startup task failed if you return an error code, which is good because that's the way you can signal. If you weren't able to do what you're supposed to do in your startup task, you should let us know because then Windows Azure will recycle the role and we'll try some other things, right? But you don't want to accidentally return some non-zero error code, which can happen if the last command in your script doesn't behave well and always return the right error code. It can also happen if like something's already installed and you try to rerun, because remember these are idempotent. The second time around, maybe it returns an error level that says, oh, I couldn't do it because it's already installed. And you don't, that's not actually an error. So think about the error levels, and one nice way to do it is just to put /B0 at the bottom. But really, you should be doing it only if you succeed. Here we're sort of assuming that everything's always going
to
work.
If it gets to this point,
Right, that it'll bail out earlier if it gets here. But anyway, I think that's an important thing to call out too.
Yeah.
Do we want to maybe jump back to my blog post so that we can hit a couple of these gotchas? Because now people have seen the basics here. Let's talk about a few ways to do this. So we should talk about the batch files in Visual Studio.
This has bitten a couple of people. So creating the batch file in Visual Studio puts a bomb in the beginning.
Byte order mark.
Right in the middle of it. And so it actually, it makes it so when it goes to execute the command line, it fails.
Yeah. Those batch files will fail.
Yeah.
So don't just file new in Visual Studio and try to create
a
batch file.
Or if you do, you can actually right-click on it and open with and use the binary the binary tool, and you can delete the few bytes.
I just use Notepad to create and then you can add it. And as far as we weren't 100% sure, so let's not say this too strongly, but I think that editing in Visual Studio after you've created is okay.
Yeah.
But
when I open up a command line, it opens up Notepad or Notepad Plus.
Yeah. So now you're not using, and I tend not to for editing the batch files. I use Notepad Plus Plus, which syntax highlights, and so I tend to do that instead of using Visual Studio. But I think that you're okay editing.
It should be after the fact.
But it's really easy to try running it locally. I mean, it'll just fail if this byte order mark there is. It'll fail. So anyway, so it's a gotcha. It's not a big deal, but it's important to know.
Yep.
Ryan had a tip. I don't know that we have to talk about this a lot, but /WCMD will just pop up a command window and wait. And that's a good way. If you put that in your startup task when you're running locally, that way you can have a command window that's exactly how everything. You're in the right directory. The right stuff is set up. You're running as the right user.
And that way, if you need to do any debugging.
So that way you can test something out and whatever. It's like setting a breakpoint.
But it's a good point. I mean, actually, the easiest thing to do is try running this stuff locally. Don't wait to deploy.
Some of this stuff is hard. Like installing the desktop experience is something that's hard to do on your desktop where that is typically already installed.
And one thing to note, too, if you're doing something with, let's say, Expression Encoder, you may have that installed locally. If you run that startup script over and over and over again, you may get certain error codes coming out when the startup task tries to run locally.
Making your background task. This is back to, we sort of skipped that task type. And task type is, I think typically people will use simple as the task type because that's the one that just runs and then it has to complete before everything else happens.
Yep.
I think that's the way to go. But when you're debugging, it means that if this thing never finishes, your role will recycle, or if it's actually hung because there's a dialog box, it'll just never finish, and you'll never be able to get to the box to figure out what happened.
You can't RDP into it and so forth. So.
And so background is the alternative that we've both been using heavily to make sure that you can get in there and see what happens.
Yeah, so if you're developing this, you're testing it out, I recommend always having it background.
Yeah.
I guess it's questionable whether it needs to be simple when you're ready to go deploy it or not.
I think the rule of thumb is to use simple when you're actually deploying in production.
Okay.
Because, for instance, if this is a background task, means your worker role will start before Encoder has finished installing, perhaps. That's probably bad.
Yeah, it could very well
I assume
be.
Your code doesn't handle that. And so simple is better to make sure that if it's a prerequisite, make it a simple task. But for debugging, background is so useful because it means that remote desktop will work.
Do you want to talk about foreground at all? Because there's a third option here, right?
I don't fully understand foreground. I mention it in my first blog post about I give a little bit of information about it, but I don't fully get it. It's sort of like background and foreground tasks in .NET, which I get more. But these ones, I didn't want to say too much that might be wrong, so I kind of left it. Logging, we've actually already showed. I think it's just a good practice to make sure you log things to a file. That way,
Absolutely.
When you connect later, you'll see them. Executing PowerShell, we saw briefly that execution policy
and
unrestricted.
Christians. Yep.
That works if you're on Windows Server 2008 R2 based machines because they have PowerShell version 2. So if you're using OS family equals 2, you'll get that. If you use OS family equals 1, here's a little command that that I haven't tried but seems.
But it's
seems
using the
like it does what
changing
it does.
The registry.
Changes the registry
to allow you the execution policy to run as.
I think that's enough about that. I mean, I don't want to read the blog post to people; they can kind of see it. This last one is a scary one. And using the service runtime, that while loop is also in Christian's blog post, so you can read both of these. The WebPI command line thing with 32-bit...
This is worth talking about.
This is a weird thing. It will have you completely stumped. The only way that I ever figured out what was going on here is because Mark Rusinovich is three doors down the hall from me, and so I got some help debugging this.
It's a nice resource to have.
Yes. When it comes to debugging weird things happening on Windows, it's pretty handy to have Mark on the team. So this is really weird. I think this gives a pretty good description of exactly what's going on. The important part is that's why we had the sandwich that you saw
on
Waves.
Let's go back to the actual.
In the startup task, probably in note. Oh, it's not open anymore. Right.
There we go.
There. These regad, all that's doing is changing the location of the user profile. Mm-hmm. It's actually a subset of the user profile.
Yeah,
it's the
shell.
Local app data. It's actually the part right after. Local app data part. Because weirdness of how 64-bit versus 32-bit works in the system 32 directory, which happens to be where the user profile is of the system user, which is the user under which startup tasks run. So read the blog post for the gory, like, why this happens. But you will save yourself a lot of pain if you just know that anything you install that's like a self-extracting executable, which is a lot of the stuff that you'll install with the WebPI command line tool, needs to be able to find itself and whatever, and we'll probably need this. And it's pretty specific to using the WebPI command line tool. Yep. But anytime you're using that, I would recommend putting these lines of code. You don't really need to think too hard about them except to see them. Oh, Wade has the broken version of these. I tricked you. This code is not correct. The little carrots to escape the percent signs, they don't work. It's supposed to be percent, 2% signs.
So
I've updated it, but I didn't share that with you.
Dang.
Yeah. But I think it's in my blog post the right way. So
excellent.
You can copy paste from the blog post and feel good. And you can read the whole thing to learn exactly how weird it was. See? Yep. 2% signs.
Excellent.
And I think this is the last.
It just shows you how important changing that back is.
Yeah, right. Because it turns out, actually, you're very unlikely to ever use that directory aside. And
other than
it's okay if it's pointing somewhere else or whatever. But I thought to be a good citizen, I should switch a bag as soon as I'm done.
Great.
The last thing is this tool psexec, which is from sysinternals.
This is a very handy thing to be able to do.
Psexec -s-i will let you run something interactively
as the system
user, so, which is the user that you'll get.
Great for debugging. So once something's failed and you're not quite sure why and you want to see it happening in real time, remote into the machine and you can run psexec there. In fact, one thing that I've been doing is during development, I've been putting psexec in the package along with my commands.
So you don't have to copy it.
So I don't have to go to a... One of the things you'd have to do is go open up a browser, download it, and get it set up. So I find it to be a nice, easy thing to do to put in the package.
So that saves a bunch of weird... Like, it works for my user when I remote in. Well, maybe it's because you're not the system user and there's some subtle difference. In fact, I really needed that with Mark's help to figure out how to do this trick around the user profile and stuff. So
so we were going to show some additional startup tasks and some
let's flash up some other, because you know what I feel like we've done now here is we've depressed people a little bit with a bunch of stuff,
bunch
and
of
really we're saving you some work and some time, so you should be happy about it. But you might feel like this stuff's kind of hard, and actually once you've got something basically working, it's very easy to this is incredibly powerful. You can do a lot of stuff.
Well, it enables a lot of scenarios that were either not possible or challenging.
Or really difficult before, right? And so this is another example. This is some PowerShell that I wrote in a startup test that is adding lines to the hosts file for weird reasons that really I don't want to even
get into.
But
it's an example. So we got a PowerShell script that's being executed as a startup. So not just a command file, just a script.
Right. And so
that's
this actual looping and whatever. Yep. In fact, there's a PowerShell snap-in that has some of the, I mean, as you saw from the example on Christian Wire's blog, you can use some of the APIs, the runtime APIs of Windows Azure from PowerShell. Yep. It's a great way for doing the things that are more complicated than you want to put in a batch file.
Yep. Or you could even create an executable.
I've done that too. I've compiled executables and put them in there.
All right, so there's that, and then...
Great, and this was the code that actually runs it, because you do need to, if you read the blog post about PowerShell, you pretty much need some wrapper to actually call PowerShell, unless you have a sign, I suppose if you actually sign the script, which I've never done.
I don't even
know how you do it. Then you might not need this, but if you don't have a sign script, then you'll need some wrapper that's actually calling PowerShell in the right way.
And one thing I wanted to show was enable 32-bit on Win64, so... If you're using a web role and running something in IIS, that might be a 32-bit process. This is the equivalent to running the encoder in the worker role. If you wanted to run it in IIS, here's an example of a script that allows you to change the app pool settings so that I think
a lot of startup scripts will start with app CMD because this is to do some IIS config.
Yep. So there's a lot of different things that you can end up doing here.
Okay, I think we've bogged people down with enough stuff to think about with startup tasks. I think you're going to see more on both of our blogs about, Wade's going to blog his full encoder solution.
Yep.
Going to blog more about, my blog now runs on Ruby in Windows Azure, and I install Ruby in a startup task, and I think that's kind of interesting.
Well,
so
what'll
I'll
be
probably do a little blogging about that, too.
We're going to talk about startup tasks a lot, I bet. As we move forward, like all the different solutions we have, we're going to leverage a startup task probably at some point here.
Yeah,
there's
a lot of stuff.
There's a lot of
useful things to do in there, so you'll see more about that. We should get to, I think, the tip of the week.
Yeah.
And as viewers of the show know, the tip of the week is the time when we unleash Bob, our editor, onto the world in all sorts of horrible ways. In all the thinking about the show, I did not think of an ask for Bob. Do we have a specific...
particular request?
Request? Does anything leap to mind? Otherwise, we have to let Bob do his thing.
Maybe we have to let Bob do his thing.
Let's let Bob do his thing.
All right.
That's every time we do that, it's very scary. But let's let's give Bob free rein. Bob, let's. Can you please introduce for us the tip of the week? Okay, that was fantastic, I'm sure. For the tip of the week, this is kind of related and kind of not, but it turns out that a lot of debugging startup tasks and things like that, you're going to want to use Remote Desktop connect into your Windows Azure instances.
We thought we might as well provide some examples.
Let's just show people how to do that because it's not... obvious, I think, right away. And we'll link to this blog post, which is by Corey Fowler, who's also one of the MVPs, the Windows Azure MVPs. He's got a nice walkthrough with screenshots of everything. But I think it would be useful in video form for us to just quickly click through it.
So we'll start with a new project. We'll create a new cloud services project. Yep. Create a web role. All right, so the very first thing is, once this builds, To set up RDP, you end up right-clicking on the Cloud Services project and selecting Publish. And from here, there's a link right at the bottom. Not very obvious, but it's Configure Remote Desktop Connections.
It's like a scavenger hunt. We just give it's a little just fun for the developer to try to find where the link is.
And so here we can enable it for all roles. Now the first thing we need to make sure that we've got a certificate set up here that we use that's also set up in the portal.
Yeah, so the certificate is for the password encryption. Yep. It's to make sure that you don't have to put an unencrypted password in the config and whatever. I'd be happy if there were an option to just use an unencrypted password, frankly, but people who are serious about the security of and who have different people who work on different parts of the project and whatever, a certificate is a good way to really securely pass things through here. So so you need a certificate to do this.
Now, I've got a bunch of certs already set up, but many users probably don't. It's nice because we can quickly create the cert right here. So we're going to say cloud cover certificate. Say OK.
It's like 3 C's in a row. It's pretty cool.
All right, it's created.
Now we got it.
Now we've got the cert. It's going to be part of the package that gets it's deployed. Now what we do is create the username password.
See, that's right over here. Here's the username. We're making full use of technology in this episode. And then the password and confirm it. You can change that account expiration date, I believe.
Yes.
And it defaults to like a month
away. A month away, yep. So we could change it. And that's just going to say that this username is valid up to that point.
Yeah. It's again, the more security conscious you are, the shorter you want that expiration date, because you want to make sure you haven't left some user lying around that people
have a password to. So once this is done, we'll click OK. And it's set. So it's saved. Next time we come in, now I'm not ready to publish this solution. But we can hit cancel.
Well, one thing, let's make sure, wait, open up the remote desktop again, because I think there's one more thing we should point out, which is after we created that certificate, we need to upload that to the portal.
Right. I was going to get there.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But yeah, so the certificate exists here. No, it's okay.
Look how long that password is you typed.
Yeah, it's a long password. okay, so we need to get that certificate and put it in the portal. And so we're going to grab a different tool, certmanager.msc. So it's the MSC plugin for certificate management. And that cert has been created here under, let's see, I went to the wrong spot.
Wasn't that the right spot? I thought it was certificates, although, yeah, I didn't spot it. Oh,
There we go.
Cloud Cover
So under the personal certificates, Cloud Cover certificate, we're going to export it. Now, the thing we need to do is export it as a PFX file, so where it's signed with a password, so that when we upload it into the portal, we put in the password and so forth. So we'll do an export. And we'll say yes to exporting with the private key.
Very important.
Hence the PFX.
Because that's the whole point of this. So the private key needs to be as part of this.
And then you give it a password. This is not the same password as your RDP credentials.
This is password protecting.
This is just protecting the certificate. Yeah. Yep. So we'll put a password. And I'm just going to export it to the desktop.
Right next to the clean me up folder, I see.
And it's been exported successfully.
Right. And now,
at this point, we'll come up here to the management portal and refresh.
And I think there's occasionally confusion. It's not as bad, I think, as the confusion used to be around this, but there's confusion about, like right here, you see the word certificate, management certificates on the left.
Yep.
That's not what you want to click on. You really want to add this as a certificate for the application that you're about to deploy.
Yep.
And so I don't know if you have a new one
I do. You're so I've got a Cloud Cover Demos project set up, and underneath there is a certificates folder.
Yep.
We'll go ahead and say add certificate. I can browse to it. Go to my desktop. And there we've got the Cloud Cover cert. Same password that we used when we exported.
Yep.
And create.
And that's about it.
And so at this point,
so once you've done that, now you're just publishing.
Yeah, when I publish my
remote desktop will work.
Yep, and you know I've already got some. That's not what I meant to do. You know that have already been set up. So you can see here's the encoder solution. I've got it set up, so ready to connect. I can remote desktop right into it.
This is very handy for debugging to be able to remote desktop, particularly I think when doing startup tasks.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
So. Good, and we'll have a link to Corey's blog post, which has basically the same stuff we just walked through in screenshot form instead in some text, which is a good reference if you want to go back and you've forgotten how to do this. I like his post a lot. I think it's a very helpful reference to go back to. Okay, with that, I guess we should wrap things up. I mean, that's our show for this week.
Yeah.
We will be back, I don't know, next week or
the week
after.
Yep.
Next week?
Yep.
I don't know if we're gonna commit to that.
We're going to try.
Okay, great. And as always, let us know what you think. Let us know what you'd like to see on the show. We are on Twitter at @CloudCoverShow. Send us a message, and we will look at it and laugh at you and not do the thing you asked for.
No,
we won't do that.
I'll do that. Wade will take it very seriously. Okay, so until next time, thank you.
Thank you.